This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin? And how did they end? Let's find out on Fan of History.
Well, that wasn't me or Dan, was it? We are having another special episode, and I would like to introduce Cy from History with Cy. And I'm a huge fan of History with Cy. I use his YouTube channel for a lot of my research before our podcast, and I was lucky enough to reach out to Cy, and he agreed to do a podcast with us on the origins of the Assyrian Empire. Since our podcast started in 1000 BC, we missed that. And Cy has a lot of really good of the old history like that on his channel, and he's just so awesome. So I invited him to do this joint podcast with me, and he's going to take most of the lead on this because he is an expert, but we're going to have one of our conversations and see where it goes. I will warn you that when him and I get talking, we could go for a while. So this might either be a long episode or a couple. So without further ado, this is Cy, and I'll just, you know, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and your channel and your podcast, and then we'll get into it.
Sure. Well, thanks, Bernie. So first of all, I wouldn't consider myself an expert. Literally, I'm, I guess, like you, a fan of history. I love this stuff. I guess history enthusiasts would be more. I have studied this. I've taken some courses and things like that, but I don't necessarily work in the field. Really, my channel started as a little passion project. Since I was young, I always loved ancient history, all history in general, but especially ancient history. And I guess I needed a creative outlet for it. So I had all these books that I had collected from used book sales, from library discards, things like that. And I guess by the time I was maybe 18 or 19 in my room at home, I had these, what my mom would call dust collectors everywhere. To me, they were like worth their weight in gold. I still have a bunch of them. Most of them I still have back at my parents' house.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something that I necessarily thought that I could make a living from, to be completely honest. And I had thought, well, it might be nice to do a PhD or something like that. But I had more, you know, pressing concerns in terms of like, well, will I get a job afterwards and how will I support myself? So I went into something totally different. I started off in IT and then I went into finance and I did that for several years and I still do. But this history, this passion that I had, I sort of put it on the back burner. Mm-hmm. And I still read books whenever I could. In fact, the first paycheck I got, I spent it on a book at Barnes & Noble on, I forget what it was. I think it was a book on Genghis Khan. But there's a, I think... which one was it? I think, I forget. I forget the exact title, but it was one of the newer books at the time.
Oh, yeah, there was kind of revised history on the Mongols.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. This must have been like, I don't know, like 15 years ago or something. But yeah, so I was always into this. And of course, when the internet came out, there's a lot more information as well. And so I loved it. And then I stumbled across YouTube.
Yeah.
And there were these, there were a bunch of different channels, but some of the ones I started watching were channels like History Time, Kings and Generals. So there's another channel, History with Hilbert.
I thought they
were really good. And you could see that these were people who were very passionate about history. They weren't obviously experts in, although the quality of their work is fabulous, but these were just people like you and me who just had a real love of history and were creating educational content for others to learn from.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was fascinating. I was like, wow, this is great. And at that time also, I had considered teaching because it's something I always loved. Even when I was in college, the best job I think I ever had was being a TA. And so I, at the time, was also getting a credential in teaching social studies. I thought, well, you know what? One day I might want to do that. And so I did that. And it just happened that through the university I was doing the credential from, I could get a 1-year like free trial subscription as a student to the entire Adobe suite of products.
So okay. That
includes Photoshop, Premiere, Adobe Audition, and like the other like 20 programs that come with it. I don't even know all the, there's so many of them. So long story short, I started experimenting with that. First, actually, my first presentation that I ever made was actually done on PowerPoint, and I recorded it, and it was absolutely terrible. But from that, I learned that, you know what? I actually enjoyed creating something, just the process of doing it. And that's when I started experimenting with Adobe, the trial subscription. I put out my first video, absolutely terrible. So I had all these tools at my disposal, and I started experimenting with them. I made a video first. I think it was a history of Star Wars or something like that.
Great.
As a test. And then I made my first history video. And that I actually put out online. And it was absolutely terrible. I think in the first 3 months, I had 15 views, of which 11 of them were myself.
Right.
So nothing to write home about. But then I made another video, pretty much the same result. But I realized that I loved just the process of creating from start to finish a video, from writing the script to recording it, and then finally publishing it, and just for the world to
right.
to view. So that's how that
What year
started.
Was that?
This might have been like around 2 years ago.
Okay, yeah, so it was pretty new for you still, because I mean, come a long way, I guess, obviously.
Yeah, that is true. It's gone by rather quick, especially the last year. But so I started, that's how I started essentially. And I think by the fourth or fifth video, I started seeing that others were actually watching them because the view count went up, people were leaving comments. And again, these were nothing, they weren't very like fancy videos. They were, the sound I thought was terrible. I still think it's terrible. In fact, those of you listening to this, you can skip the videos from the last, I don't know, well, you can the earliest videos. Don't worry about it. You just go to the last year.
I tell you there. I mean, he's very humble and modest because the videos are really good. He Cy uses a lot of maps, and I feel when ours is a podcast. So when I'm doing the podcast with Dan and I'm explaining to the listeners, I don't know. It's hard to maybe figure out where all the cities are and these areas that we're talking about unless you have a really good map in your head. Or you're looking at one, I think, in my opinion. And size maps are really good, and you can see he puts the time into them. You could see, where. So it helps me when I'm researching it. So, and it's really cool now that YouTube's, most people's TVs have YouTube on them, so you can just kind of watch a show, just like as if you were watching a movie. And I fire up History with Cy. It's History with Cy, right?
Correct.
Because sometimes I say by Cy by accident, but it's History with Cy. I mean, and he has thousands and thousands of subscribers and listeners, so. Kudos to you.
I mean, thank you. I actually love, when it comes to the visuals, my favorite thing is actually to make the maps because along with being an astronaut or all the things that little kids want to be when they're young, I actually wanted to be a cartographer, believe it or not.
That's right. You told me that. That's amazing. Not a lot of people want that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've always loved maps, geography, things like that. I remember when I was a kid, I'd design my own little treasure maps, and then I'd start copying maps of the different continents and making... It was just something fun for me to do.
Essentially, you're an overachiever, I think.
No, I just have a lot of weird hobbies that... To be honest, thanks to YouTube, I kind of have an outlet for it. And again, that's how the channel started. And from there, I also started converting some of the episodes into podcasts. So especially the longer ones. So now you can technically say there's a History with Sci podcast. And that's pretty much my story.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. I did, like I said, I reached out to Sci and I think we're friends. We became friends pretty quick anyway. We didn't have any short words.
Pennsylvania.
That's so true. I forgot about that. Sci lives in California now, but he's from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, when I'm in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So, I mean. And we recently learned that in Philadelphia, there's an amazing museum, the Penn Museum, with tons of Mesopotamian artifacts. So that's going to be a road trip one of these days, too.
Definitely. Yeah. It's funny because I've been to Philadelphia, but I never realized that museum was there.
I know, me neither. I'm closer, so.
Yeah, exactly. When I think of museums, I think of the Met or the Smithsonian. But it's funny, though, because a lot of the books I read, they reference a lot of studies that were done by the University of Pennsylvania, especially back in the 1930s. And I just never made that connection.
I was just as guilty, I have to admit. So now that the pandemic is getting sort of winding down, we can start traveling. I'm definitely looking forward to taking a trip down.
My next trip, I'm going to do a little museum tour when I'm on the East Coast.
Yeah, we'll have our tour. So today we said, let's do a podcast together. And Sci has a lot of the older stuff, like I said. So I thought, well, why don't we do it on the beginning of the Assyrian Empire? Because in our podcast, we're coming towards the end, unfortunately. We'll be doing the 630 soon. So if anybody knows what happens to the Assyrians, we know they're not still here. So eventually they had to stop. But when they started was a long time before the 600s BC. So it's a really interesting story, and I'm going to just let Sai sort of take it, and I'll ask questions in between. How's that sound?
Sure. I'll do my best to answer any questions you might have. I mean, just based, again, on what I've read, what I've studied over the years, if I don't know the answer, I'll try to find it for you.
Exactly, and I'll just edit it out anyway, so you guys will never know. Kidding.
There you go.
Yeah, so I'll let you take it away. So tell us about the beginnings of this Assyrian Empire.
Sure. So most of us actually are familiar. When we think of ancient Assyria, we think of some of the scenes that are in the Old Testament of the Bible. For example, Sennacherib, his siege of Jerusalem. There are other stories or mentions of other Assyrian kings. For example, the one in the Bible they called Pul, but we know is Tiglath-Pileser III, mm-hmm. very powerful king. And the reason is because in those days, Assyria, or what we call the Neo-Assyrian Empire, was the superpower of the region. They had absolutely no rival. So all of these little kingdoms in the Levant, Israel, Judah, Moab, the various Philistine states, Phoenician city-states, they were all sort of under the thumb of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. And even when you see all of these artifacts and, for example, winged bulls and these cuneiform documents, most of them come from that time, the Neo-Assyrian period.
Yeah.
And so I started learning more about that. And in my studies, I saw that this is only the final phase of Assyrian history, that the further back, the Assyrian history is one of the most continuous civilizations of the ancient world. So for example, you have various Babylonian dynasties, you have the Hittites that were there. Well, Egyptians were a pretty continuous civilization as well. But Assyria, that was something that I had never known. And I think most people actually, they don't realize that Assyrian history goes back at least until 2000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm going to say 2000 BC.
Right.
The Neo-Assyrian structures that we look at, most of them come from maybe the 700s, 800s BC. But 1,200 years earlier, Syria appears in various historical documents. We have a lot of evidence, not just at the city of Asher, but in places as far away as central Anatolia, which we're going to get to in a second. So I was fascinated that mentions of Assyria had gone back to at least 2000 BC. And the civilization, obviously, or the city that we know as Asher, probably existed before that as well. Now, the story of Asher is actually quite interesting. I myself have not been to the site, but I've read a decent amount about it. And it's the site that eventually became Asher was initially the site of a small temple dedicated to a god of the same name. So Asher the city and Asher the god are, in a sense, related.
Okay.
Now, this site of Asher is located in what's today northern Iraq, not too far from the city of Mosul. And it's on a branch of the Tigris River that's somewhat elevated, and it's on kind of this crag that extends into the Tigris River, and it's overlooking these mountains in the distance, but it's overlooking also these, what I guess would be considered, especially in those days, very fertile farmland.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a peaceful place. I'm sure those back in the day, when they were sitting on the little crag of Asher, they could look out, you know, towards the horizon, maybe see shepherds with their flocks, the various mountain ranges in the distance. And of course, you had a relatively peaceful section of the Tigris flowing beneath it.
Yeah.
And the land was also good for small farms. You didn't have to irrigate them as much as you would, for example, in southern Mesopotamia, where the terrain is much drier, it's more of a desert.
Yeah.
I mean, these are like rolling hills.
It's more of a temperate area up there in the north, I believe, right?
Correct, yes. So this area, what would generally happen when you would have these, you know, spots like this, in this case, it's a small mountain crag. Other times, you know, it could be like a little spring. But the locals would always think that, well, this must be the home of a god. Some god must live here because it's such a great place. It's evergreen. And so it was believed that a god named Asher lived here. And there was a small temple. Now, over time, there started to be small settlements, perhaps a village around the temple. And this god Asher became the patrons of those inhabitants that surrounded this area. Again, as time went on, more people probably came. The location of Asher is also quite strategic, actually. It's in a section of northern Mesopotamia where several trade routes cross through. So, for example, it linked the lands to the east, Elam, various areas of the Zagros Mountains, with lands to the west in Anatolia, and as well as lands to the south in Babylonia, or what we would call the lands of Sumer and Akkad back in the day.
Right at that time, right.
Later on. Yeah, because I guess by then So the time frame we're still in is probably around between 2200 and 2000 BC. That's
2200 to 2000 BC, these settlers started to sort of move into that city, that area. It wasn't a city, obviously, yet. They were starting to build and put some farms around the mountain that was Asher.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but by this point, I would say it would be like, it's more like a small town, you could say, for those days.
Okay.
Probably 5 to 7,500 people. And so during the time, there was a lot of instability. It was a time when the Akkadian Empire that had been founded by Sargon the Great was pretty much breaking apart, if it hadn't already. And in between, you had a lot of these little breakaway states. If you look at the literature of the time, especially the Neo-Sumerian literature, they talk about a people from the Zagros Mountains called the Gutians, who sort of came in and started causing havoc. Now, scholars debate whether they were the actual cause. Probably not. They might have been more opportunists who came as the centralized state of the Akkadian Empire broke down, probably due to climate change, drought, So, but it's described, at least in the text, as a relatively chaotic time.
Yeah, when I was doing some reading before, I read that a lot of scientists believe there was a drought and then about 2200 BC, a pretty bad one.
Correct.
All over the world, really.
Exactly, yeah. And that probably caused a lot of instability, starvation. And when you have those conditions, you have a lot of unrest that it generally leads to revolt.
Yeah, and people start moving around. They have to leave one place. They got to go to another place.
Exactly. So there was a lot of instability. And again, the texts, I guess the Gutians become the scapegoat.
Yeah,
but
sort of like the sea peoples.
Exactly. In that sense, they're just sort of blamed that, oh, it's the Gutians who did this. But
right.
They were rather, in my opinion at least, I think they just took advantage of the situation because in those days, I guess sometimes even now, people from the countryside, they're generally looked down upon by city dwellers.
Right.
So they had always been seen as these sort of uncouth, uncivilized people. In fact, Sumerian documents of the time, they say they are people who resemble men, but with canine intelligence.
Wait, they resemble men with canine intelligence?
Correct.
Oh, boy. How's that for racist?
Yeah, that's... They're just... The Sumerians, especially during the Neo-Sumerian time, they were a very proud people.
Yeah.
They felt that
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I guess there was no other civilization like them.
Yeah.
And there never had been. And to some degree, that is a bit true, perhaps with the exception of Egypt.
Right.
I don't think that there was another civilization as advanced as they were at that time period.
Yeah, or maybe in India too. But that was around this time is when the Indian, I think, civilization started to collapse. I mean, the Indus Valley. I think it's around 2200 where they started dealing with problems with the. They say the rivers changed course too around then in India. I wonder if the Tigris or have maybe changed course that it was in a perfect spot in Asia around that time.
That's possible too, yeah. I mean, the rivers, both the Euphrates and the Tigris, definitely changed over the course of, hundreds of years,
right,
for sure, sometimes even decades. In fact, what's really interesting is that, and this is why irrigation became so important, more in southern Mesopotamia than in the north. I think it was more stable in the north,
mm-hmm,
but in southern Mesopotamia especially, you were never guaranteed that the course of the Tigris or the Euphrates or any of their small branches would run the same course as it had the prior season.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that's why they really relied on irrigation, because with irrigation, at least, even if the course of the Tigris changed, they could at least extend their irrigation networks.
Right.
If worse comes to worse, you dig some more canals and things of that sort. It wasn't like the Nile, for example, that would consistently flood around the same time every year,
right,
and leave this rich deposit of silt. The rivers of Mesopotamia, they were a bit more capricious. They just kind of had a mind of their own.
Right. Yeah. That's why the kings were in charge of the canals, and things were such an important, you know, part of being a king.
Oh yeah, canals were huge, actually.
Sure, I built canals. I did these, I did that. You know, even in China, it was a huge thing. I mean, of course, it does bring life. I mean, you have to have water for food and et cetera.
Exactly.
So yeah, so up north there, they started to settle in. We've talked about this before personally. Like, we don't get into this racial thing. What these people? But the people that we think kind of moved in, were they were Akkadians, I think, maybe.
Correct. Okay. Yes. So it's very interesting because they are mostly Akkadian as far as we know. The way we know this is through the names of various kings, names that are found in documents. They are pretty much, I would say, I think about 80% Akkadian names.
Okay.
But if you go back to certain periods, in fact, so they have it. It's kind of interesting. The Assyrian king list, it's broken into different sections.
Mm-hmm.
So what we'd call the historical kings are those that we can or have been somewhat proved, their existence has been somewhat proved through archaeology. But before that, you have what are called kings that kings that were ancestors and kings that lived in tents.
Oh, yeah, kings that lived in tents. Yes, I read that.
So these were probably their ancestors when they were still nomads, before they had settled in Asher. They had this oral memory of who their tribal chieftains were, and they called them kings.
Right.
But essentially, I think if we were to look at them now, they were probably a little more than tribal chieftains, various tribes and things of that sort.
I feel like the Assyrians called small kings everybody a king. I think they get a bad rap of, like, some of the kings themselves get a bad rap of saying that they're sort of like egomaniacs because they call themselves king of the kings or king of the world. But I think king of the world and that just means you're a bigger king. You know, you're a real king. You're a king of many places.
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting how just the concept of kingship also sort of evolves. Because as we'll see in early Asher, the king technically was the god Asher. So even the term Syria, it's a Greek term, but it's their way of saying Mat Ashur.
Okay.
Which basically means land of Asher, as in the god Asher.
Oh, so that's so, right. So the king, and did you say in the beginning the king was the god as well?
Well, the king is always the god. That's the thing. The man, he just, the ruler of the Assyrians, I mean, he goes by
king. Oh, I see what you're saying. Asher is the king, and then the king of the human king is the representative of Asher on earth.
Exactly, the vice regent of Asher.
Gotcha, but he wasn't a god like the Egyptian pharaoh was supposed to be the god, but he was, I follow you.
Yeah, so in this sense, he was the god's representative on earth, and we use the word king, and later correspondence, when the Assyrian king would write letters, so this was several hundred years later,
mm-hmm.
but when he would write letters, for example, to the Egyptian pharaoh or to the Babylonian king or the king of the Hittites, then he would also address himself as a king because that's just the term they would use. But in theory, he was, for the Assyrian people, he was not the king. He was the representative of the king.
Gotcha.
But the king was always the god Asher.
And so is that why the kings always look the same then? And their carvings? Is that part of the reason maybe?
They had this, same hairstyle, same...
Yeah, it's the same guy, basically. I mean, Ashurbanipal put that little quill, or I keep calling it quill, but the writing, you know... Mm-hmm. Stick. he shows that it's him, but basically their faces all look the same for thousands of years.
Yeah. I mean...
So they are very... The Assyrians are... I mean, we know, like, from their later history, and I bet it maybe somewhat started in this ancient history, they're very conservative, and they seem to be concerned about the forces of chaos around them. So they want their king, or their human king on Earth, to protect them from the forces of chaos, and that's where Asher's god is. And one of the ways, of course, they end up protecting from the force of chaos is unleashing it on anybody outside of their area, you know?
Yeah, that definitely later on for sure. But what's fascinating is that 1,500 years before all of that, they were literally this small, I mean, we would call in our day like a village,
yeah,
or a small town perhaps. In those days, it was a city. But probably at its height, and when I say at its height, I'm talking about maybe, you know, 2000 BC, it probably had between 5 to maybe maximum 10,000 people.
Okay. Not a very
but
big city.
But that also, that's debated because as we're going to see, what happened is that a lot of those people lived abroad. So a lot of residents of Asher lived abroad.
Oh, tell me about that. Yeah.
Earlier, we were talking about how Asher was at a very strategic location, that several trade routes kind of, you know, passed alongside it, passed near it. It was at a nice spot in northern Mesopotamia where the Tigris River flowed. You had various mountain passes or hill passes, mm-hmm, where traders could bring caravans from different areas. So the people of Asher, I mean, it was a really insignificant town except for its location.
Mm-hmm.
And so over time, I mean, and I guess this is the ingenuity of the people, the early Assyrian people, is that they started to realize that, you know what, we can actually really profit from this,
mm-hmm,
not just as a little way station for good, but perhaps being proactive and going out and kind of and making connections with other cities, developing deeper ties with them. And eventually they started building, they started having colonies within these different cities.
Oh, I see. Yes.
These
like a Greek quarter, like you have the all through history. I have like the Greek quarter, the American quarter, or the British quarter.
Exactly.
They'd have the Assyrian quarter in another city.
Quarter in a lot of these cities, especially in Anatolia.
Yeah.
Because what they would do is they would be there, they would trade, they would bring textiles from Babylonia. So what would happen is Babylonia was known for its textiles. Those would be shipped to Asher. And then the people from Asher, the Assyrians, Assyrian traders rather, they would act as sort of a middleman. So they would take those textiles to the cities of Anatolia, one of the most famous being a city called Kanesh, also known as Nesha in Hittite, but in Assyrian documents, it comes up as Kanesh. And they had these probably several thousand Assyrians living there in, as you said, an Assyrian quarter that was essentially take these textiles and trade them for precious metals, for example, tin, which was making bronze. So, and, you know, this part of Mesopotamia, especially in southern Mesopotamia, tin is not something that's native to the area, so it had to be imported, as did copper and all these other metals.
Right, and just in case anybody doesn't know, remember, tin, you need tin to make bronze. And this is the Bronze Age.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So they'd get all these tin and other metals as well from Anatolia, and they'd bring them back, and then they'd sell them to other parties, maybe some parties in Elam, but mostly to the people of Babylonia.
Right, that was their best customers probably down there for a lot of it. So you could see when you think about where Assyria is at the time, too. I mean, it's definitely a crossroads because you have Urartu in the mountainous area above there. They must have had some interesting things to buy from them. Probably didn't sell much to them. Well, who knows?
Yeah, those were the Hurrian people, actually.
Those were the Hurrians in the mountains?
Sorry?
The Hurrians were up there in the mountains where like Urartu eventually would become?
Some of them, yeah. They were actually spread out, but they were north of Assyria, actually.
Okay.
And going back to what you were saying before, this is actually, I forgot to bring this up. So when I said that about perhaps 80% of the people were of Akkadian origin,
mm-hmm,
the rest actually, if you look at these king lists, there are actually certain names of kings, what they call some of these earlier kings, that have what appear to be like old Hurrian names.
Okay.
So that rather than just being a very homogeneous population, Asher probably also had other different types of or other groups of people there.
Yeah.
And one of them being perhaps maybe a significant Hurrian minority.
Huh. Yeah, I get the point that I get the feel, the vibe that Assyria was never a race to be. It was a culture. If you're like an American kind of, where you're supposed to be an American no matter what.
Especially later on as the empire grew, it became more, if you could, I guess, I've read that they identified themselves as Akkadians.
Okay.
And that was their language. So, for example, what we call the Assyrian language was pretty much the same as the Babylonian language, but they were different dialects, mm-hmm, of Akkadian. So back in the day when archaeologists were first uncovering this stuff, they called basically all cuneiform Babylonian.
Okay.
Because they thought that Nineveh was actually part of Babylon and all of the other surrounding areas, even the city of Ur, for example, before they learned how to really distinguish, before they determined that these were all separate languages.
Gotcha.
Or separate dialects, everything was called Babylonian.
Gotcha.
But the language is actually called Akkadian, and you have a Babylonian dialect, and then you have the Assyrian dialect. And they've, of course, evolved over time, but...
And they're both Semitic. That's all Semitic. A Semitic
correct.
Language, right? Akkadian, all those are Semitic. But Sumerian is not a Semitic language, is that correct?
No, Sumerian is a language isolate. So that's actually a very mysterious language. They don't know exactly where it came from,
right?
Because it's unlike any other known language.
Right, so, one of those deals.
So, for example, Akkadian, it's, I guess, what we call an Eastern Semitic language, which is very similar to Western Semitic languages, even modern languages like Hebrew or Arabic, for example.
Right, yes, the Hebrew
grammar,
and Arabic are also correct.
Similar sounding words, but...
Sumerian, not so much. And that's why Ashurbanipal says how hard it was to learn to read and write Sumerian when he talks in his annals.
There's a very famous quote here where he's like bragging to the world.
Right, how good he could read all these other languages. So
And then he can solve math problems that have no solution, apparently. And it's just really funny. That quote, actually, I should read it, actually.
Which is the quote?
The quote by Ashurbanipal, it's really like, it's the most, I've never seen a king or anyone really brag so much about their intelligence, with the exception of a former president who shall not be named. But
the whole time, honestly.
Former U.S. president.
Yeah, he reminds me of them. He reminds me of Syrian kings.
There's actually, Syrian. I can probably bring it up later on if you want, because I used it actually in another episode. But basically, he's saying that, I was able to read Sumerians that even the best scribes couldn't read, and I conversed with all the best scholars, and I found the solution to math problems that don't even exist, which sounds kind of weird.
Yeah, that one was weird. I know we covered some of it on one of our podcasts, but I know I didn't say that one. I remember reading that, though, when I was reading it. That is odd. Like Sennacherib, he told you that he could, he literally actually did learn how to do some kind of different bronze casting. But Ashurbanipal, man, he just brags about everything.
Yeah, he was less of a warrior and more of a scholar.
Yeah.
I think if he had his way, he would have rather just, lived a life of luxury in a library somewhere versus
exactly.
The battlefield. But going back to the early Assyrians. So they had set up these trading colonies all over various regions, but the most famous ones were in Anatolia, and they'd do this exchange where they would mostly exchange textiles for tin and bring that back to Asher, and then it would be they'd be distributed to other areas. Asher was sort of a trade hub, a regional trade hub.
Gotcha.
And
I just wanted to ask one other question. Is Hurrian a Semitic language, or is that a different language, do you know?
No, that's a different language.
Okay.
It's a different language group. So
gotcha. All right. So basically we have these Anatolians and 80% Semitic peoples and Akkadians that founded Asher, the city, a trading post of Asher, way back 2200, 2000 BC.
Yeah, actually, probably the shrine town was established before that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But Asher really starts to appear in the historical record around 2000 BC.
Okay.
So, and they're supposedly mentions of it from, they may perhaps a little bit earlier in Akkadian documents.
Okay.
They're not 100% sure, but I think they found some seals that are of the former Akkadian governor of that region. So those would be probably around like 2200 BC, for example,
okay.
That there was an Akkadian presence there.
Because it did become part of one of the empire. And I hope I didn't just jump the gun on that, if I did.
No, that's fine. Yeah, no, it was a part of these empires, but it was a very insignificant town. It was like one of these small towns.
Gotcha.
That's at least what's
been. It wasn't even like a city, state. It was just a little town that was become part of other empires, either as a vassal or as a actual
exactly
part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, I mean, the, I guess you could say all the big urban centers were further south,
right?
Those are where you had, I guess, the real cities, for example, Uruk, Ur, Lagash, that's, I guess, that's where all the action was.
That was all, where all the action was down in the south, and this was a little backwater up in the north, and this is this kind of how they, and then it sort of ended up being that way for hundreds of years, where the, I don't think the Babylonians like being ruled by the Assyrians.
Yeah.
As
yeah,
these that was, northern no, bear.
Let's go to that big rivalry, which I'm sure you guys talked about in your podcast, because that's...
Yeah, we're right in the heart
after
of it.
After 1,000.
Yep, we're right in the
that's
heart.
That's actually one of my favorite times. Just,
yeah, there's a lot of information, too. Helps. I mean, it's not
yeah,
like,
it's like every
know.
Every 5 years, there's a new rebel king in Babylonia, and they have to kind of come down and sort of deal with them. And,
right.
And in some cases, that same rebel comes back. It's really... Marduk Apla Idina, that's the
yeah, he's
really
good at pronouncing.
One,
but... you guys check out Sai's channel. He's I listened to it so I could pronounce it properly before.
I'm hoping I'm pronouncing them properly. But so yeah, so Asher then around 2000, it's this town. And for the next 200 years, it's really interesting. We have a wealth of knowledge. When I say we, I'm talking about archaeologists. They've uncovered a wealth of knowledge both in the city of Asher itself, as well as in these Anatolian colonies that sort of outline is how business was done. You had these everything from these like joint stock companies to individual merchants, and they have uncovered, I think, something like 10,000, at least 10,000 documents, if not more, many of them being not just mundane commercial accounts, but letters between families. So, for example, between fathers and their sons, husbands and their wives, just about all.
Where did they find these? In houses, basically? Like in digs in the house? Or they weren't in a library or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. They were probably, they were in this Syrian, many of them come from Qanish, in this Syrian quarter.
Okay.
And then the ones from Asher, the further down, deeper that they would dig, they would find them in the remains of what they believe were houses or
okay.
maybe storehouses.
So it's a real look at like real that. Life because they're just letter letters. They're not a king list or something. I know. Should I should read. I know you have a couple of these here. I should maybe read one or two of them, right?
Sure, sure.
Like this is just a letter. So this doesn't have any big political point to us. It's a letter from one person to another, right? So here's one. He says, here's a letter where it seems that the grandkids have renounced or cast off their grandfather, right? I have raised your son, but he said to me, you are not my father. He then got up and left. Also, your daughters I have raised, but they too said, you are not our father. 3 days later, they got up and left in order to go to you. So let me know what you think.
Yeah, that's funny. Actually, that's a really good one. I know exactly which letter you're talking about. That's a letter the... So what had happened, the scenario here, is that the father had gone off to one of the colonies, I believe it was Qanish, and he was kind of out of the picture and mm-hmm. had sort of dumped his kids on the grandfather. But as the kids got older, they started to assert their own independence, and it seems like they were basically, I don't know, just trying to maybe leave the house, or I think the grandfather was perhaps putting too many rules on them.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know what? Forget you. You're not even my
kids
dad.
These days, right?
I don't need to listen to you. Oh, these days, those days. I mean, I guess that doesn't change.
It never does.
So
it's so funny, so, right? Yeah, so it seriously is that. The grandfather's right. And your kids are just, they're not like kids these days.
So it's just other ones. So yeah, that's an example of one sort of, you could say, family letter.
And then I think there's another one you have, because remember you told me about it. And I haven't read it. I'm going to read it out loud. But it was a letter from a wife to her husband complaining about not having enough money.
Mm-hmm.
So where did they find this one before?
What else hasn't changed?
I'm sorry?
That hasn't changed either. We have a lot of these things also.
This guy maybe was in Anatolia, and then they found this letter that she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you wrote and said, guard the bracelets and rings you have so they may be available to pay for your food. In truth, you sent me a half a pound of gold with Ilbani. But what are those bracelets that you left me? When you went away, you did not leave a single shekel of silver. You picked the house clean and took it away. Since you left, there has been hardship and hunger in the city. I keep buying barley for our food. I guess that means she's not able to grow her own or whatever. Maybe barley wasn't such a good thing.
So barley was like cheap.
Yeah,
or
crappy. Yeah. What is this extravagance that you keep writing about me about? There is nothing for us to eat. Do we live in luxury? I have picked clean everything in my possession and sent it to you. Today I live in an empty house. A year has gone by. Do send me money corresponding to the value of my textiles out of your available funds so I could buy 10 measures of barley. With respect to the tablet, with witnesses concerning Asher Imiti, son of Kura, which he got a hold of, he caused trouble for the household and took slave girls as pledges, but your agent cleared it up, and I had to pay 2/3 of a pound of silver. Until you come here, he will not make any claim. When you come, you will still have to negotiate. Why do you keep listening to slander and sending me heated letters? So Demas have been sending her letters saying that she wasn't taking care of the house.
Exactly, yeah. So yeah, you have a lot of letters like this, you know, this sort of back and forth between the husband and the wife. Now, sometimes the husband, you'll have, some of them are kind of, they're really interesting. There'll be the wife writing to the husband saying, oh, so I understand why you haven't been sending money, because I heard, and maybe this is a, you know, sort of a reference to like the slander or whatever. Mm-hmm. But he's like, oh, I heard that you have, you know, you have taken another wife and have a whole, you know, other family there in this Anatolian town. And that's why you're not sending me the money and, you know, the things like that. And you know, there would.
Those are great little views into real life. I do have a question. I have a wonder, though, about the writing. Do you think that this woman, you know, the wife wrote it? Did she have a scribe? So I imagine these people must have been somewhat more of a higher, you know, higher echelon of society, I guess to say, if they knew how to read and write.
Yeah, most likely she had a scribe or a, I guess what we'd call a professional letter writer.
Okay.
Compose this for her. Like she would dictate it and then he would write it. Because in those days, most scribes were male.
Right, okay.
And depending also on the family. So upper class families, they could actually afford a tutor for their children to learn basics of, they weren't scribes necessarily, but they could, you know, learn to read and write some of the basic signs,
right.
The most important signs,
yeah,
for correspondence like this.
Yeah, because there's hundreds of them. So I imagine there's a lot of different levels. Even like today, we could have a certain level of reading, but you would.
Correct.
You need a lot more education to get a level that we have today, even like a first grader. You'd probably take years of learning cuneiform and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the scribes themselves, the when you look at all the signs they had to memorize,
yeah.
Just how, I mean, I think they're quite complicated.
You know what I feel like coming to learn, and maybe this will help people, you know, because I've been studying this forever and I can really understand it. So I think like cuneiform and hieroglyphics, they're sort of like writing with emojis, but then or sort of like trying to figure out a code. You know, like it's almost like if the word, because they would just sound like the word, right? So like, I can't think of an example, but maybe like, oh, headphones, for example. Yeah, so headphones would be a picture of a head and a picture of a phone. And you'd have to know that means headphones. You know, and I think, and that's kind of how it started, right? I mean, then these symbols, but a cuneiform of a head doesn't look like a head anymore, but that's kind of how it started. So that's how you had to sort of like interpret these. And of course, and there's no spaces between the words either, which has got to be maddening.
Yeah, especially, you're correct, especially in Sumerian, because I think I read about 90 to 95% of Sumerian words are just one syllable. And so
right. It
was easy to have, say, one symbol for each word.
Right.
And then, as you said, you could combine different signs for different meanings.
Right.
So, for example, let's say you had the sign for a head, which would mean a person or a human. And you had another sign, which independently, let's say a bowl. So that's, you know, by itself, the bowl would mean, you know, food, or there's another meaning of that.
Right.
But anyway, but if you combine them, so if you have the head next to the bowl, that means to eat.
Right.
So
that's even
like
harder, because
that's
not a syllable at all. That's a picture from a picture, right?
Yeah, so you'd have to like combine them.
Right.
I guess you'd have to know the connotation of the
right. Of
the text you're reading to see that, oh, okay, this must mean this and not something else.
It was definitely complicated and not good for emails or texting.
No.
Could you imagine having to text in cuneiform?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, that's kind of interesting, because when they text in Chinese and Mandarin,
yeah,
they also have to like go through various all the different
signs. That's right. Probably the same kind of a thing.
So it probably would have been something like that. I wouldn't.
Ancient text. So yeah, that is a funny. That, I love those letters. Those are great. And so this basically this period, like we say, you said, I should say, that Asshur was not quite the city that a city even at all. It didn't have a king and had sort of a trading post, but there was Assyrians all over. It's sort of traders. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, like the Canaanites were the Phoenicians, they were like traders like that too.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like
they were, I guess, yeah, they were also trading at that time too. Yeah,
probably.
But I think they were, they became really much more famous later
on. Of course,
though.
Of course.
Like, I think as they started developing their navy and their merchant fleet, that's when they became really, really...
I have another question that just reminded me of. So, being that the trade route, so we always say that the Assyrians weren't big on their navy and sailors. But so did they sail the boats up and down the... Did they sail boats up and down the rivers to trade for goods?
That's actually a good question. I have not read something specifically on that, though I imagine they would have, right. Or at least people would have perhaps shipped. I'm assuming that the river at the time was able to be navigated.
Right.
So I think that probably would be the case, but I myself have not specifically read that, so I don't want to say something incorrect.
Well, we're going to get back to you guys about that. We'll look that one up. Because the river must have flown south, right? So, I mean, it flowed south towards the Persian Gulf. So, you know, I think in Egypt, I remember learning that in Egypt, the wind blew one way, but the river goes the other way, right? So it was a great river to navigate, except for the rapids, where you can't go.
Yeah, especially once you were away from the various cataracts, right. Which I guess, I think they end in... Southern, I shouldn't say end. They probably start there, depending on where you're coming from. But the cataracts start in Nubia.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking I think around the Aswan area. And then...
But we know that the Egyptians sailed up and down the river, but I don't know about the Mesopotamians, but we'll definitely look that up. But, you know, the river is still a good route. I mean, they could use barges and I'm sure they're
glad. I do know in later time... Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just saying it's flat. A river goes usually pretty flat. A river's not usually like right in a mountain. The beginnings
correct,
of them are.
Yeah.
You know.
And I don't think you had many rapids or anything like that in Mesopotamia. But they did sail them at one time, but later, because there are texts where Sennacherib is talking about this was one of his I guess disastrous campaign against Elam.
Yes.
And he does talk about transporting troops.
He did.
In Phoenician boats, basically.
That's the thing,
They were manned by Phoenicians. Yeah, I think because they were part of the empire by then, so I'm sure they... I think the Assyrians were also good, like other peoples, they were also good at adopting the best practices of the people they conquered.
Mm-hmm.
So no one could really beat the Phoenicians when it came to shipbuilding.
No.
So I'm sure they brought a bunch of Phoenician shipbuilders, I guess at that time, to Nineveh. And they had them build boats specifically for this invasion. And then they sailed them down the Tigris.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they
landed the troops in Elam for that.
Yeah, it was a two-pronged attack. Actually, what he did at the time was he sailed them to the mouth of the Gar. So he had two forces. He had one that left from Babylon, or I guess just east of Babylonia. Sorry, east of Babylon.
Yeah.
So that part of Babylonia into Elam. But another bulk of the force actually... It said they crossed the Gulf, and they landed in, I guess what in those days was southern Elam, what today would be like the province of Fars, like on the Gulf. And both of these armies were supposed to go and take Susa. They failed, but that was at least one instance.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first issue. That's the first reference I know of them, you know, using ships on the rivers. And so that's a lot later. So we'll have to look that up and wonder. I imagine they use it for trade, but they obviously didn't have naval battles on the river, but for trade.
Well, we also have definitely for trade in the sense that I can't recall any specific Assyrian document, but I know that there are documents from the Third Dynasty of War, the Neo-Sumerian Empire, because there's a city, actually it's not even a city, it's a small town, a few kilometers outside of what was then the holy city of Nippur. It's a site called Pizrush Dagan.
Okay.
And long story short, it was a It was basically a large warehouse. It was a town that was like a large warehouse.
Okay.
And from there are all these documents that have been uncovered, all these commercial documents. And some of them mentioned, for example, wheat and cattle being loaded on, both loaded and unloaded on boats and sent to different locations throughout the empire.
Yeah.
Basically, every month or so, they would collect taxes from different parts of the empire. So all these boats, they would come to Nippur, where they were essentially then divided up and first sent to the temples, then to the various, to the royal family, and then any nobles, and then distributed to the, I guess, the common people in the empire. But a lot of these items are at least recorded to have come on ships.
That's very super interesting, actually.
So I'm sure the Assyrians did it too.
Yeah.
It's just that maybe the kings were still spending more time bragging about their accomplishments and how great they were and how they could read Sumerian versus the everyday stuff of, or everyday little mundane things like shipping wheat between one city and the other.
Yeah. I mean, we needed all these. Yeah. It's traders and business people to keep the world fed, right?
That is true. They're the unsung heroes of any empire.
Right. I mean, they're doing it to make money for everybody, but everybody needs to eat. So anyway, sorry, I stopped that, your train of thought there.
No, this is, I just love having discussions like this. So this is fine. You feel free to interrupt anytime. I mean, I don't look at this as I look at this more as like a conversation.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Just two friends talking about some interesting stuff. And
this is, to the listeners, I will tell you, this is how I could cheat, and I don't have to do tons of research. I'll get an expert like Sion to help me with that. I know enough to be dangerous.
Yeah, if I gave you like 5 books, you'd probably know more than I would.
Well, it's possible that I have to read them.
Just from reading. I just love reading, and I guess, it's just something that...
And then I forget. You guys have good memories. I have to write it all down. So Syria now was a trading area, and it's kind of part of the empires, but then we sort of get some kings, right? And then I'll let you go on from there, yeah. I will indeed let Sai go on when we return with part 2 of this topic, the beginnings, the origins of the Assyrian Empire. Do not miss it, because we have some really exciting stuff in the next episode, too. See you next time.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just $1 an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.